Let me speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Last week in the archaeology of a story, I noted that John's approach to story is different from that of Mark, Matthew, and Luke, where stories flow out of events. In John, it's the other way around. The event emerges out of the story. A good example of this is the first of John's seven signs of the kingdom, the much-loved story about the wedding at Cana in Galilee. Is this a real event, or is it an event created by the story that John tells to make his point about Jesus? John's stories are created to reveal Jesus' identity rather than as accounts of what he did, what did or did not happen. Today we are 2 weeks away from the start of Holy Week, a week ending in the great 3 days of Easter. On the fourth Sunday in Lent, the scene opens on the sixth sign among the seven signs of the kingdom in John's Gospel. Today we have the healing of the man born blind. And there's only one sign left after this, the raising of Lazarus. And it's a time-sensitive story that prepares us for the journey through Holy Week and into the great 3 days of Easter. Now, I'm struck by the way John constructs this story. It's not a story about any old blind man. It's a story about a man born blind. It's not a story about a man who loses his sight through some misadventure. It's a story about a man born into a state of blindness. Now, there are two groups of bystanders in this story. There's the man's family and his neighbors. And then there's the godly, Jesus' disciples and the Pharisees. The man's neighbors are perplexed, but on the whole, overjoyed at the man gaining his sight. The godly types are perplexed and downright disconcerted. And so they ask, "Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that this man was born blind?" And Jesus will have none of this. He answers their question with neither. Jesus spits on the ground and he makes a poultice of mud. And he spreads it over the man's eyes. There's another whole sermon in this simple act. For here we see once again the homeopathic principle in operation. The Hebrew word for ground is adama. And the first human being is called Adam. Genesis tells us that Adam was made from Adama, the ground. We are formed out of the dust of the earth, and it's this same dust that holds the key to our healing. But I digress. Having spread the mud poultice over the man's eyes, Jesus tells him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. And he does so, and he returns able to see for the first time in his life. An outcome, as I said, that amazes his family and neighbors, and yet deeply concerns the godly bystanders. Their question to Jesus is not about, was this man born blind, but who sinned that this man was born blind? You see, blindness is not the issue here. It's sin, and particularly the punishment for sin. And today we understand that in pre-modern societies, illness and sin were very closely aligned. Sin explained the arbitrary nature of illness. Why him and not me? Why me and not her? We don't think this way today because in the wake of the advances of medicine, we know better. Or maybe it's just that we think we do. Medical science has no answer for the sheer arbitrary nature of the way illness strikes some and not others. Despite its tremendous advances in understanding the sources of illness, we're quick to disavow sinful behavior as a cause for illness. Yet beneath the surface, accusations of carelessness and negligence in lifestyle often persist and are not a million miles away from the notion of sin and blame. The why him and not me question lies at the heart of the godly bystander's question, who sinned? Medical science may explain the causes of illness, but it remains silent before the question of suffering and punishment. Sin as a cause of illness at least addressed the question of suffering and punishment head on. And no amount of medical knowledge can reassure us against the arbitrary nature and the indiscriminate injustice of suffering. Nevertheless, we still seek reassurance in the way we try to distance between those who suffer and those who don't. We're not that different from the godly in John's story. We have many ways of assigning blame to reassure ourselves that we are different from the ill who suffer. She's only got herself to blame, we say, if we're brave enough, or simply think, if we're not. After all, he should have worn a mask. Or they should have been vaccinated. Or even more far-fetched, it's because they were vaccinated that they became vulnerable to the infection. She should have smoked less. He should have drunk less. You should not have eaten so much. Our need to pronounce judgment is endless. And what matters is that we find an explanation to reassure ourselves that we are not vulnerable. And so we draw distinctions between conditions that we could reasonably catch and those we feel safe from catching, allowing for the hypothetical that we may all develop cancer. We feel safe around cancer patients because, after all, they have it and we don't. We comfort ourselves with the knowledge that we are not a member of a vulnerable population that is genetically predisposed to diabetes or heart disease. And we congratulate ourselves on controlling our food, drinking in moderation, and exercising regularly. And so, protected by the illusion of reassurance, we are too ready to sit in judgment on the afflicted. As we continue to recover from the coronavirus plague, as a society, we've been shocked by how hard it is to maintain the fiction of a protective barrier between them and us. How easily we reverted to the ancient fears of contamination from conditions transmittable by air, through touch or proximity. How quickly those in authority stoked public fear as we reverted to the ancient remedy of quarantine with all its attendant moral judgments. We've been painfully reminded of what it feels like to be treated as a plague carrier. We've quickly rediscovered that quarantine is as much a moral as it is a physical segregation. And having worked for 18 years in acute mental health ministry, I've long pondered the public fear of those who experience mental illness. Who says the practice of shunning is dead? Following one of my first patient groups, one man who seemed struck by my rapport with the group came up to me afterwards and asked me if I had ever had mental illness. To which I replied, "So far, I've escaped diagnosis." Mental and emotional disturbance, whether it ascends to the degree of psychiatric diagnosis, is a matter of there but for the grace of God go we. John's story of the man born blind, the sixth in his seven signs of the kingdom, is a theological story. It's about revealing the identity of who Jesus really is. It's about the movement from blindness to sight to insight. It's about Jesus' ability to cure a blind individual but seemed powerless to open the eyes of the community. It's a story about denial of human vulnerability and our conflation of illness and suffering as punishment. In John's story of the healing of the man born blind, Jesus challenges us to open our eyes to a new world view and turn away from judgment and embrace our common solidarity. If we can, what will we discover in moving from blindness to sight and from sight to insight? In his 1947 novel, The Plague, Albert Camus echoes John's portrayal of the tensions between Jesus and the godly bystanders. He contrasts the responses of the town of Oran's doctor and its parish priest. The priest condemns the suffering and sees a way of explaining it away as God's punishment for sin. Who has sinned? the disciples ask Jesus. This man has sinned by healing on the Sabbath, the Pharisees contend. And both seek to distance themselves from the arbitrary and indiscriminate nature of illness and suffering. Camus' doctor knows that suffering is a cosmic tragedy, and if accepted as such, it actually leads to the softening of the human heart. Camus' doctor says that the only way to fight the plague is with decency. And when asked what decency means, the doctor responds that decency is doing my job. Decency and doing my job means committing to lives of courage, lives where trust is fueled by hope. Not the fairy tale hope of religious faith as some kind of magical protection or some divine insurance policy. A denial of our human vulnerability. But the hope rooted in the refusal to be defeated by fear in response to the seeming random unpredictability of illness and suffering. The man born blind moved from blindness to sight, from sight to insight. And when we do likewise, we find a surprising discovery. In the face of fear, we just need to be decent enough to do the job God has called us here to do. And what is that? At the Last Supper, having washed his disciples' feet, John has Jesus give them a new commandment, to love one another so that the world may know them by their shared solidarity with one another. That's what I think love one another means. Not having sentimental feelings about each other, but being committed to stand in solidarity with one another, particularly in the face of illness and suffering. Accepting that we're all vulnerable to the misfortunes of illness and suffering, that we're all in this predicament together. This is the greatest sign, not only of our Christian, but of our human capacity for solidarity, one with another. Amen.